Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
John Williams here with Eric Zorin, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel. Eric, the longtime columnist at the Tribune, now publishes a weekly newsletter, and a lot of folks dial into that. There's a free edition, and for just a little bit, a premium edition that gets you even more insight and commentary and comedy. Eric, of course, is a member of our Mincing Rascals podcast panel each week and has been the keeper of the fantasy division of the worst teams in baseball ever. You going to go to the White Sox game this evening, Eric?
I'm not going to go this evening. I'm going on Thursday afternoon. I'm hoping to see them. It sounds like such a terrible thing. I'm hoping to see them lose their 123rd game, which would assure them of the title of the worst team in baseball history. Right now, there were people have been focused on 120 losses, and the White Sox are at 120 losses already with six games to go. And my contention is that that record should have an asterisk by it, because the New York Mets set it in 1962 when they were an expansion team. They went 120-40, and that means that they did not play two games. There were two rainouts for the end of the season for the Mets, and they just didn't make them up. I guess people just figured, well, this is stupid. We don't have to let the Mets keep losing. So they set that record, but in only 160 games. The White Sox are going to have to play, or probably going to play 162 games, although the weather doesn't look all that great right this minute. So I think that 120 record should have an asterisk by it, that the odds are really good that the Mets would, if they'd played a full season, they would have lost at least one more game, probably two. So if the White Sox can lose three more games out of the last six, which sounds like a pretty good possibility given the way they've been playing, then they will have that record without an asterisk. If you remember the asterisk debate in baseball had to do with like the home run record and whether Roger Maris deserved the home run record because he got to play in more games than Babe Ruth and all that. I mean, this just goes back to our childhood. But baseball is very obsessed with records, and they also are obsessed with how many games have been played. So this is really interesting right now. This team is historically bad, no matter how you look at it.
So you're going to give the Mets two more losses, and the magic number for you is 123. But the world seems to be recognizing tonight is the game to go to.
Well, I hear you. You're going, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, I should go. You're right, but maybe I'll change all my plans and go. The world recognizes it, and I've been trying to mention this for the last month or so. Like, hey, remember that 120 was set in a shortened season. And there's another record that's outstanding out there, which is the record of the 1916 Philadelphia Athletics. And they have long been considered to be the worst team in baseball history, because they finished with a record of fewer games, and they finished 36-117, which is a winning percentage of 235. And actually, if you expand that winning percentage out by another decimal point, it's 235.3, like one extra thing. If the White Sox go 38-124, they lose 124 games, that'll be 2346, just like, you know, just micro underneath the Philadelphia Athletics of 1916. And that will win them the title for sure, the unalloyed title of the worst team in modern baseball history. So we have that to look forward to also. 124 is another benchmark to look for.
With six games. So in other words, if they lose four of the six games, there'll be no argument they will be the worst team ever.
Yes. Yeah. And this is going to be one of those things that people are going to argue about for generations if they don't get to 124 losses.
I want Jerry Reinsdorf to throw out the first pitch tonight. What do you think the odds are that's going to happen?
I think that the White Sox are just going to have to be in a total defensive crouch right now. It's got to be tough on the players to be. I've certainly played on losing little league teams, you know, where you couldn't win a game and so on. And it's dispiriting. On the other hand, these guys are paid pretty good money to play a game. And so I think we're not going to have any pity parties for them. But it's ironic that this is the year that Reinsdorf has been trying to get taxpayers or legislators to pay for a new stadium for him. It's like, hey, let's have more of this in Chicago. I think that people are going to be saying, hey, let's get to Nashville, get this team out of here.
There's so many schools in the Chicago public school system that have less than 50% occupancy because kids are not in those neighborhoods. They don't need all of these schools. Those schools are staffed, though, with faculty and administrators. The Chicago Teachers Union wants to keep those jobs, but the CPS, Pedro Martinez, the CEO of the CPS, feels like maybe we should close some of these schools. What's your opinion about that? What should happen to those schools?
Well, Martinez, who is currently the CEO of schools, has denied that he's thinking about closing schools, although evidently the Chicago Teachers Union has a hold of a document in which he has had people explore the ramifications of closing some of these poorly attended schools. Because, the district has lost a lot of students over the last year. It's shrunk about 20% in terms of enrollment over the last decade. And so you have schools where there are very underutilized. And the system is facing a fairly serious budget deficit, about close to $1 billion, $933 million in the next fiscal year, out of a budget of close to $10 billion. So it's a significant deficit. And right now what's going on is that Brandon Johnson, the mayor, is pressuring the CEO, Pedro Martinez, of the schools, who reports to him. He's pressuring him to resign. Now, Martinez was an appointee of Mayor Lori Lightfoot, but is well regarded. And there were 460 district principals and assistant principals who represent 70% of the district campuses. They recently wrote to the Board of Education urging them to keep Martinez on. They're going to be meeting on Thursday, the Board of Education, and they may vote to dismiss Martinez, which is a complicated process that may involve getting him out after 6 months and having to pay him a bunch of severance and everything. And the reason that they want him out is because he is refusing to take out a loan, a payday loan of about $300 million to help pay for the new teacher salary demands and other things that are going on in the school. So this is a huge problem for the mayor. And certainly people in the city are looking at this going, well, how are we supposed to pay for this? These loans that, and politicians do this, Daley did it, Emanuel did it. They take out loans to pay for today's bills with tomorrow's money, and they kick the can down the road. And Martinez is making what many people consider to be the financially prudent decision, which is, hey, we need to figure out where to get this money, and we don't have it now, and the state legislature doesn't seem to want to pony up for us. And so we're going to have to do something, raise taxes, fees, and all that to pay for this. And so the idea of firing Martinez because he is being fiscally responsible is really galling to a lot of people. And just last night on Chicago Tonight, Channel 11, Brandis Friedman, the host, asked the head of the teachers union, Stacey Davis Gates, like, well, how are we going to pay for this? You guys, have all these contract demands. They want 9% raises every year, and they want, full staffs at all these schools, which, I'm all for teachers and I'm all for well-equipped schools. But this is a good question. Where's the money come from? And whenever she's asked this, Davis Gates basically says this is not her problem. And she answered the question by telling this long story about a woman who got another job to pay for her own expenses. So she says, this woman figured out how to get new revenue into her household so she can buy a car to get her child to school. So Pedro Martinez can't tell us no, that cuts are okay. When black single mothers every day in the city are figuring out how to make ends meet and how to do that with a smile, he has to do more than say cuts, closures, and consolidations. This is Stacey Davis Gates' answer to this question of where's the money going to come from. Brandon Johnson doesn't really have an answer to where the money is going to come from. And this is a thing that I think a lot of citizens in town are saying, oh, wait a minute. Mayor Johnson has a big progressive agenda. He's got a lot of nice things that he wants to do, but he does have to figure out how to pay for them. And where's that money going to come from?
It's not her problem, Stacey Davis Gates, but you are smart enough to see that it's like wishing the sun didn't rise in the east, but there it is. So while there's nothing she can do about it, other than maybe, compromise some of the demands, but that even that doesn't generate money. And weren't the raise proposals for the teachers 4% and 5% over 3 or 4 years? So
that was the counteroffer that the public schools have made. They're in contract negotiations right now, and that was the reported counteroffer was, I think, 4% every year for 4 or 5 years, and the teachers have been asking for 9%.
Yeah, well,
and again, you know, teachers are heroes, I think, and they deserve to be paid well for the important job that they do. But this is, and I know you're right, it's not Stacey Davis Gates' problem exactly, but when you're asking for something like that from a system that is in the red, you are really putting the schools in peril. You're putting them in financial trouble down the line. You're trying to meet today's demands, and I think that they need to figure out a way to work together. I would like to see Stacey Davis Gates and Pedro Martinez and Mayor Johnson and everybody else, and working with some of the legislative leaders, J.B. Pritzker and Speaker Welch and Leader Harmon and so on, down in Springfield to figure out how to do this. I don't feel them all pulling on the same oars together. I feel like they're all looking at their own agendas and not looking at what's going to be best for the kids in Chicago.
Just one last thing, Eric, and then we'll just have a minute to talk about ShotSpotter. But it does seem to me like with all of the buildings and all of the personnel in Chicago and fewer students in them, that some consolidation makes sense. If Pedro Martinez wants to back away from that, I think that's unfortunate, because even though that will involve some kids having to travel farther to go to school, that is the reality of the situation.
Well, yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that the alarm over school closings is really something that needs to be dealt with. And I think that the what you're saying is exactly right. That at some point you have to make some cuts, and yes, I think, and basically I agree with you on that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Okay, so ShotSpotter. ShotSpotter has lapsed. Now the mayor is trying to replace the technology, and it might be the same company that provides ShotSpotter technology rebidding for the job. Is that right?
Yeah, it's very weird. You know, last week he was voted down by his own council. He's going to have to veto their measure that they wanted to take this contracting authority away from him. That 14 out of 17 aldermen who have ShotSpotter in their districts want to keep it. The superintendent of police wants to keep it. There's evidence that it saves maybe up to 85 lives a year by getting first responders to the scene more quickly. He wants to end it. It costs about $10 million a year. He pulled the plug on Sunday night. The CWB Chicago crime block has already started a count of Brandon's bodies, which they claim are going to be people who were found having been shot and later than they would have been because of the technology being pulled. He's put out a request for proposals, a request for information, I should say, for first responder technology, which Jake Sheridan at the Tribune described as basically similar to the proposal. What they're asking for is something very similar to what ShotSpotter already did. And the question that Jake asked at a news conference yesterday was like, well, why are you putting out this proposal now, when you announced much, much earlier this year that you were going to get rid of ShotSpotter, and you waited till now to put out this proposal? And his answer was something like, well, some things take time when you're going to do it right. A reasonable timeline is to do it right. It's to do it right. I'm going to do it right. This is Mayor Johnson's response to why he hasn't been trying to figure this out in advance. So this is, you know, we just spoke earlier this half hour about the schools problem, which is, of course, right on Mayor Johnson's plate. And now we've got this problem, too, which is neighborhood residents, a front page story in the Tribune today, residents talking about how they're scared about what's going to happen now that the police are not going to be responding more quickly to gunfire incidents.
I don't want to be the mayor. You guys are doing Songs of Good Cheer again this year. This will be the first announcement on this show of anything Christmassy, I would say. But I can get tickets to the annual program, right?
Yeah, it's a sing-along show that Mary Schmeek and I have been hosting at the Old Town School for 26 years now. We get this cast of great musicians together on stage with us. And, you know, you've been there. You've emceed it for us many times, and we hope you'll do it again this year. And we just do a selection of holiday songs. We pass out lyrics, and there's always new stuff that people have never heard, and plus some old familiar stuff. And Mary plays a pretty good piano, and I you know, I crack jokes and play a little fiddle, and yeah, it's a good time. And the tickets have just gone on sale at the at oldtownschool.org. And so I hope that people come and join us out there. It's a really good time. It's become this tradition that a lot of families, they come one year and they bring more people next year and bring more people the next year. So tickets go fast, and we're really excited about it.
December 12th through the 15th, the 26th year at the Old Town School of Folk Music. Am I going to be invited to introduce you guys on stage one time?
Always, John, always.
I wonder what night I should pick. Do I get my choice?
At this point you do, because I don't think we've lined up our MCs yet.
Well, if invited, I will serve. Let's just put that out there, okay?
We'll definitely invite you, John. Thanks.
And then you also had a story here about Heavens to Betsy, a guitar-related story. Is that right?
Yeah, I was looking through some photo archives at my parents' house over the weekend back in Michigan, and I found this photo of me when I was age four holding this guitar, kind of pretending to play it, obviously, at age four. And it's a guitar that I've had by my desk here in Chicago for many years. It's a family heirloom in a way. It's an old junky guitar by now. But my daughter played it at the first waltz at my son's wedding earlier this month. And so there's a picture of me at age four playing it, and then my daughter playing it, 62 years later. And it just, and there's these so side-by-side pictures in the Picayune Sentinel this morning. And it just talked to me of, and I'm not really into gear. I'm not into like exactly what make and model of instruments they are. I just kind of care what they sound like. But I am really into the history of instruments, the personal history, and the idea that this guitar, it was named Betsy because my father's colleague in the graduate school had been dating a woman named Betsy and gave her a guitar. And when they broke up, she gave him the guitar back and he didn't want it. So he gave it to my dad. So the guitar's name is Betsy. And it's a sweet thing. And every time I belonged to my aunt for many years, and it's a junked up guitar, but it sounds kind of good. And I love that idea. And the guitar I was playing at my son's wedding was a guitar that was passed on from my musical mentor when I was a child. So there's this history that flows through instruments, and I was just honoring that today.
Every time I see Glenn Hansard's guitar, I think, dude, you could get a better guitar. It looks beat to pieces, but it sounds pretty good, and I think he's attached to it.
And Willie Nelson's too, yeah.
Yeah. Eric Zorn, I'll talk to you tomorrow on the Mincing Rascals podcast.
Look forward to it, John. Thank you.